Good morning. I'd like to take this opportunity to welcome our testifiers and everyone in the room today to State Government Finance and Policy on this Thursday, February 26, 2026, and with that we are calling this meeting to order. I'm going to move the approval of the minutes of February 19th. Is there any discussion to the February 19th minutes? Representative Joy.
Madam Chair, I brought this up before that we did not list nonpartisan on this, and I see it's still not on there. Is there just a reason we don't want to? Is it just something that just for non-transparency, or what's that? What are we doing here?
Thank you, Representative Joy. We did some research onto that. Generally speaking, if nonpartisan is presenting a presentation, or if nonpartisan is walking us through something, and we are asking them to do that as a bill, right? Then sometimes we would put it in the minutes if they are actually presenting. But generally speaking, when they're clarifying questions or House protocol, we do not include that in the minutes. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think one of the big precedents is if somebody actually sits at the testifying location, that should be listed, because generally the nonpartisan staff talks back where they're sitting. Now, I mean, it was requested by members of the committee that be entered in the, is there a reason of which the chair desires not to have that listed?
Representative Quam, as you mentioned to me at that meeting, or at the last meeting, there is an audio of what is done. I would like everyone to just take a look at this room. I would like for you to see where nonpartisan staff is currently sitting. They are sitting at tables that do not have microphones. I want you to look at the dais and see the seats are taken. The only place that there is a microphone for them to be recorded in the audio, clarifying these questions of policy and procedure, is at the testifying table. So there was no hidden motive. It's just that's where they can sit.
So Madam Chair, at the
Representative Quam.
Oh, certainly I'll let you speak and not reply to my statement that people here, as members of the committee, requested it beyond the minutes. And I don't understand why the chair, especially during a meeting in which we weren't allowed to speak. So I guess the chair will just do whatever the chair wishes, because the chair isn't listening to members on the committee.
Representative Quam, you act like I'm upset that I just said your name. I was merely identifying you for the record so that people knew who was speaking. I'm not arguing with you at the committee table. Coacher Nash, is there anything you'd like to add?
Proceed as directed, I guess. I think it's probably worth us talking about this later, Madam Chair.
Thank you. So I move the minutes of February 19th be adopted as written. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails and the minutes are adopted. Thank you. A division?
On the minutes?
Okay. Okay, so for the members who do not, well, for the public, when a division is called, there has to be a show of hands of who voted yes and who voted no. We can do a roll call. Thank you. A roll call has been requested. Please take the roll.
Chair Cleaborn?
Aye.
Chair Cleaborn, aye. Chair Nash?
No.
Representative Nash? No. Representative Bonner?
Aye.
Representative Bonner, aye. Representative Davis?
No.
Representative Davis, no. Representative Anderson?
Anderson, no.
Representative Anderson, no. Representative Clardy?
Aye.
Representative Clardy, aye. Representative Freeburg?
Yes.
Representative Freeburg, aye. Representative Nicolai?
Aye.
Representative Nicolai, aye. Representative Jones?
Aye.
Representative Jones, aye. Representative Joy?
No.
Representative Joy, no. Representative Kosnick? Representative Koznick. Representative Kraft.
Aye.
Representative Kraft, aye. Representative Quam.
No.
Representative Quam.
No.
Representative Sexton.
No.
Chair, there are 7 ayes, 6 nays, and 1 excused.
He's making his way here as we speak.
Okay. So, members, this is a most interesting dilemma that we have in a tied legislature. We have just asked nonpartisan if we can adopt minutes on a vote of 7 ayes and 6 nays because we are in a tied legislature. At this moment, we do not know if this motion has prevailed or failed. So we will have to take this back and do research based on the vote of 7 ayes and 6 nays. We will move on to our agenda items. Welcome, Secretary of State Simon. We appreciate your being with us this morning. When you are ready, if you would please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. Steve Simon, Minnesota Secretary of State. It's a pleasure to be with you all today for this opportunity to present an update, which you asked for, on the status of the Business Identity Recovery Program. It's a program that was passed into law through this committee last year and went into effect on January 1st of this year. Before I get into the details of the program, I just really want to take an opportunity to thank a few people in this room, particularly Representative Ryer, who was the chief author, but the two co-chairs of this committee, you, Madam Chair, and Chair Nash. And at the risk of making you blush, there is no way this thing becomes law without the three of you. The chairs, in particular, were involved in many extensive behind-the-scenes meetings where we overcame and figured out creative ways to address real challenges. It's legislating the way legislating should be done. It was utterly nonpartisan. It was not under the glare of the spotlight, which is okay. It's okay. A lot of things should be public. I just mean no one called a press conference. No one tweeted about it. It's just good policy that got done by people of good faith. So thank you very much for that. The program has been in operation for less than 2 months. It went into effect January 1st. As you'll see in the presentation, it's already having a meaningful and positive impact on Minnesotans. So this program, this new program that you passed, addresses what is really a truly nationwide problem, all 50 states. It's business identity theft. And business identity theft occurs when someone makes a change to an existing business or registers a new business without the consent of the owner. So the fraudsters often use these filings to take out loans in the business's name, causing damage to the financial health of the business and its owner or owners. Now, before we implemented this business identity recovery program, our office had no recourse to help impacted individuals. They would call us, they would contact us, they'd say somebody hijacked our business, and what we legally had to say was, we're sorry, we don't have the legal authority to do anything about it. You're going to have to lawyer up at your own expense, considerable expense, go to court and get a judge to agree with you and order us to undo that filing. That's the way it worked before this law was passed. It was time-consuming, it was expensive, it was a hassle for all involved. This new program, one of just a handful of the nation, creates an administrative process at no cost to the victim to determine whether a filing is fraudulent. This process ensures most disputes are resolved faster and with less cost to the victim. Now, the new process is very simple for the victim of a fraudulent filing. An individual who believes that they or their business has been defrauded files a short declaration with the office, shown here on this slide and on the next few slides, alleging their business records have been tampered with or otherwise altered without their permission. The most common cases we see are, first, a company is created in somebody else's name. Second, an inactive business entity is reinstated without permission of the owner. And third, the address or information on a company's business filing is changed to an unknown third party. So the person filing the declaration, the person who believes they've been defrauded, can attach any documentation they want to support it, but they don't have to include anything at this first step if they don't want to. They can just say, hey, I've been the victim here. They can simply return a completed declaration for the process to begin. They do, however, have to attest under penalty of perjury that the information they provided, if any, is true and accurate. That goes without saying. So on this next slide, you'll see page 2 of the declaration, which contains the information the person making the declaration must provide for the office to take action. When a declaration is received in our office, the staff immediately send a letter to the person who is alleged to have made the fraudulent filing. So the alleged bad guy gets a letter automatically. That person has 21 days to respond. If they don't respond in 21 days, or if the letter is returned as undeliverable, then the filing is deemed fraudulent. So on this next slide, you can see the third page of the declaration, which contains, among other things, the required affirmation that the information provided is true and correct, and a brief description of what the declarant, the person filling out the declaration, can expect to happen next. Now, from the experience of some of the other states with a similar program who got a head start on us, who are 1 or 2 years down the road, we anticipate that in most cases, the person alleged to have made the wrongful filing will not respond to the office's request for additional information. In other words, we'll send them this notice, we'll give them 21 days, and we're not going to hear from them. But if they do respond, our office gives both parties the opportunity to provide additional information. And once both parties have made their submissions, our office determines whether the filing is fraudulent using the factors you can see in this slide. The non-prevailing party can appeal the office's decision to a district court. That's important here. We aren't judge, jury, and executioner in our office, and maybe we made a mistake, or maybe we didn't have all the facts. We only have the record before us as submitted by both sides. So there's always an out. There's always due process. Could be we got it wrong. So someone can always appeal to court. The next couple of slides explain how the redaction process works for any filings determined to be fraudulent. So this is after we've already made a determination that it was bad and it was fraudulent. This record that you see here is from one of the first cases that we handled after this took effect just a few weeks ago. It involved a change of registered office that was filed on July 17, 2025. The real business owner submitted a declaration to our office of wrongful filing earlier this year, after January 1st. The person who made the July 17th filing never responded to our office's request for additional information. That's that 21 days. So the filing was deemed fraudulent by our office. The office restored the previous names and addresses and marked the fraudulent filing with the note, as you'll see here, removed per Minnesota Statute 300, as highlighted in yellow on the slide. This next slide shows an example where a person created a new business that was deemed fraudulent as a result of using the address of a random Minnesotan. The entity remains searchable via our online Minnesota Business and Lien System, or MBLS, but the business name field and filing history contain the notation that says, quote, removed per Minnesota Statute 300. The remaining unauthorized information, including addresses and names, are wiped from the record. Now, some folks have asked, I don't blame them, why are fraudulent filings redacted rather than removed entirely from our system? The answer is that we redact the filings so that banks and government agencies that rely on these records know if certain documents were submitted at one time fraudulently. So it's completely transparent, nothing's airbrushed out, it's all out there. So just transitioning to implementation for a second and the execution of the program. The Declaration of Wrongful Filing became available on December 24th, 2025. In other words, a week or so before the January 1st go date for the law. So to date, because we knew you'd be wondering, we've had 54 cases. This is less than 2 months. We've had 54 cases that have been filed. 24 cases have been resolved without response from the filing party, which is what we predicted. These folks are scammers. Of course, they're not going to reply to anything that the government sends them. They're just going to disappear. So 24 of those 54 were those cases, no response whatsoever. 29 cases so far are awaiting the 21-day deadline for a response from the person alleged to have made the fraudulent filing. One case was handled with a simple phone call to clear up a misunderstanding. And I think that's particularly important to highlight. That last case is interesting because we were able to resolve it just with that phone call. Prior to the implementation of this law, again, we had no authority. I mean, I suppose we could try to coax them into doing the right thing, but we didn't have the legal authority that you then gave us last year to correct things that were made in error, even if they were honest mistakes. Not all of these, I should point out, and this is a good example, not all of it's fraud. Sometimes it's a misunderstanding, sometimes within the same family. You have a family-owned business, one person files, and the cousin or the uncle disagree. It's not even a dispute, they just misunderstood one another. So these individuals still had to get a court order, this is prior to the law, directing the record to be corrected. Now, when we identify that a filing was made mistakenly, not even fraudulently, just a mistake, like a family business, uncle thought cousin was doing it and he didn't, or he did, or whatever it was, it can work with the affected parties, our office can work with the affected parties to resolve the matter without asking them to go to court. That's another important service that we can now provide Minnesotans as a result of this legislation. So this next slide summarizes the common issues that declarants are reporting. Approximately half the complaints, the 54 we've gotten so far, involve changing the information on an already existing entity. So approximately one-third of the complaints made so far are due to a person reinstating a dormant business without authorization. And one-fifth of cases involve a new entity being formed using the name or address of another person without their consent. In many cases, victims are reporting multiple issues in their declarations. So we're already using this data to take steps to help business owners understand how they can avoid being victims of fraudulent conduct. For example, many businesses become dormant on our system because the owner or owners just fail to file their annual renewal. Maybe it was a hobby business, a side gig, something like that, and they just don't want to do it anymore, and they just sort of leave it sit on the records. So oftentimes, that's what we're seeing. But under state law, dormant businesses can be reinstated at any time with the appropriate payment. So someone might have a hobby business, they decide, you know what, for family reasons, other reasons, you know, I'm just going to let it lie. I'm not going to undo it or take it off the record. I'm just kind of going to let it sit on the record for a few years, and 10 years later, they come back to it wanting to take it up again. So these dormant businesses are often targeted by bad actors who reinstate a business for fraudulent purposes. Business owners can protect themselves from this possibility by making sure that they follow the legal process to dissolve their company when they no longer wish to operate it. So in the example I use, you don't want to do it anymore, family reasons, had an extra kid, you know, whatever it is. The best practice, we can't make anyone do this, is to just dissolve it. And you can start a new business in 2 years or 5 years or 10 years. That's just a gloss on or a take on that old name. That's the safer path. Not something they have to do, but the safer path. So state law provides a process by which they can do this and notify our office of the dissolution. If they follow that process, their business can never be reinstated on our system. Given the number of fraudulent filings being reported related to reinstated businesses, we are working with a lot of business groups and others to educate the business community to make sure that they follow the dissolution process when they're done with their business. Again, they don't have to, but that's available to everyone. We'll continue to expand our educational efforts as we get more data from this business identity recovery program. So to summarize what you've seen today, the office has taken advantage of the support that you have provided us by developing a process that is easy to use, cheap, and quick. We've noted on this slide some of the many benefits of the program, but I think it's most important to highlight that already this program has saved thousands of dollars in legal fees and court costs for dozens of Minnesotans who have been affected by business identity theft. Again, we're grateful for the support of this committee in delivering a program that is delivering meaningful and positive results just 2 months after implementation. So Representative Ryer, Chair Cleavorn, Chair Nash, thank you. You really went the extra mile. You didn't have to. You did. You saw a problem. It was nationwide, utterly nonpartisan, and you did something about it, and we're grateful for that. Finally, just on a more whimsical note, I'll conclude that we've already received positive feedback from those using the program. We highlighted this on the office's Instagram, the first declaration that was delivered to our office after the January 1st effective date, and someone came back a few weeks later, as you'll see, and posted a positive note. So with that, I'm available, and so is our Business Services Director, Adam Hansen, to answer any questions or take any of your testimony. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you so much, Secretary of State Simon. Thank you for alerting us to this important issue and a better way to help prevent fraud in our state. Is there any member discussion, questions for the Secretary of State? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks for the good report. Just a kind of a basic question. Does any business that operates in this state, large or small, have to be registered with your office?
Secretary of State.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson. I mean, pretty much. There are exceptions. There are sole proprietors, for example, that don't have to register with our office. But the vast majority do, yes.
Any follow-up? Okay. Any other questions? Chair Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Secretary, thanks for the update. I think you left a couple people off the thanks list, and it was our staff, Ms. Rudolph, Mr. Grunhauser, your staff, who I think we were actually walking quickly down a hallway where we said, let's just do this, and they got it all taken care of. This was a good thing to get done. I've heard from folks who are on both sides of the aisle, business owners, as we were moving through this, they're like, thank you for taking a very thoughtful approach to getting this done, because it is a real problem. And I think that what we'll see is a lessening of fraudsters. I kept waiting for you to say, three or four bad guys called us and said, yeah, I'm a certified bad guy trying to steal the business. But alas, that didn't happen. But I think this is a good preventative measure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Secretary of State Simon, do you have any closing?
I don't. Yeah. I just want to thank you. I mean, it really is a good model, right? Good things like this can get done when legislators and staff think creatively about challenges and get it done. So thank you all.
From your lips to the committee's ears.
Right.
So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for always focusing on the work of the people of Minnesota. I appreciate you.
Thank you.
Next, we will move on to Representative Ryer. This is House File 2904. I will move House File 2904 to be laid over for possible inclusion. I understand that you have an A1 amendment. Would you like to speak to the amendment?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, Chair Nash, committee members. The A2 amendment proposes, to start over, the bill as it was originally drafted proposes a large systemic change to the healthcare system for school employees. And as such, we know that it needs to have many conversations and have a great deal of work. To enable this work, the amendment defines a mandatory report that will provide district-level data about employees and potential employees, enrollees, plan offerings, actuarial values, and plan financials, such as district and employee expenditures. That is a piece that, if we can move forward with that, will provide the information that will allow us to design a actuarial sound and work with the administrators and boards to have the information that we all need to be able to design a good system, which is already framed up in the core legislation.
Thank you. And earlier to the coming together of this meeting, Representative Sexton mentioned that he would like to offer a friendly amendment. I would like for him to just let you know what that friendly amendment is. So, Representative Sexton.
Madam Chair, that was actually for House File 3422.
Oh, excuse me, I'm so sorry then. Then we just have the A1 as it is. And members, we generally let the author have the bill in the form that they would like to have it, as we've discussed previously. Since this bill is being laid over and there's opportunity to do work, I would like to move directly to the vote and have a roll call vote on the A1. Members, I will ask that the roll please be taken.
Chair Cleburne?
Aye.
Chair Cleburne, aye. Representative Nash?
Aye.
Representative Nash, aye. Representative Bonner?
Aye.
Representative Bonner, aye. Representative Davis?
Aye.
Representative Davis, aye. Representative Anderson?
Aye, if that was me. Okay.
Representative Anderson, aye. Representative Clardy?
Aye.
Representative Clardy, aye. Representative Freeburg?
Yes.
Representative Freeburg, aye. Representative Nicolai?
Aye.
Representative Nicolai, aye. Representative Jones?
Aye.
Representative Jones, aye. Representative Joy? Representative Joy, aye. Representative Koznick? Representative Kraft?
Aye.
Representative Kraft, aye. Representative Sexton?
Representative Sexton, aye.
Representative Sexton, aye. Representative Quam?
Aye.
Representative Quam, aye. Chair, there are 13 ayes and one excused.
With the 13 ayes and zero nays, the author's amendment is adopted to your bill as amended. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee members, for accepting the amendment. So the healthcare system in the United States is broken. Spiraling costs, administrative complexity, and inequitable access to affordable care. For-profit businesses are exploiting the healthcare system to increase their own wealth. And employees in school districts across Minnesota are suffering the effects. This year started with 3,200 teachers in Anoka-Hennepin on the verge of a strike. The big issue wasn't working conditions or salaries. It was skyrocketing health insurance costs, a premium increase of 22% in a single year, family premiums cited at $1,000 a month. Escalating health care costs are not just a big district problem. In Spring Valley, a sixth grade teacher at Kingsland Public Schools with 44 teachers put it this way, either I get insurance or I get a paycheck. The current approach just doesn't make sense. Each district paying its own brokers, managing its own contracts, absorbing its own shocks when an employee needs high-cost care. Each district, whether they have 3,200 teachers or 44. These unnecessary administrative costs take money from investing in students, and the inefficiency is breathtaking. This is a workforce issue. School employees change districts in pursuit of decent access to health care, and far too many dedicated people are forced out of education entirely due to this unsustainable system. House File 2904, the bipartisan educator group insurance program, proposes a single large pool for all Minnesota public school employees. It creates more financial stability while eliminating haves and have-nots among the districts, more stability and less administrative waste, and less money to companies like United Health Group, which paid its CEO $26 million and returned $16 billion to shareholders while a teacher in Spring Valley was choosing between her paycheck and her family's health care. 2 years ago, the Minnesota legislature made a historic investment in public education. In district after district, most of those gains have been swallowed by insurance costs before they ever reach a classroom. Minnesota educators shouldn't have to choose. This legislature has the power to make sure they don't. I ask for your support on House File 2904. Thank you.
Up for the whole day. With your consent, Chair Nash, we need to discuss the minutes, how we adopt the minutes or not. Could Mr. Gehring please come forward, understanding that there is he still here? Or did, oh, I can't see him. Yeah. Oh, thank you. We do, yeah. Or Mr. Sullivan, whoever, just to clarify the minutes for us. I'm so sorry, Chair Representative Ryan. And again, I'm asking you to come to this table because it's the only place there's a microphone. Would you please explain to us the minutes and the voting procedure also, if you don't mind, for adoption of minutes?
Madam Chair, sure. So, is there a specific question you'd like me to answer or other members would like me to answer?
We would like for our membership to truly understand, one, we are in a tied legislature. We are unsure about the requirement. It is my thought that we have to have a vote from each side if a division is called. But on a voice, but I would like for you to just clarify that for the body, if you don't mind. So I, as a member, am asking for clarification.
Sure, sure. Madam Chair, so some of these questions are questions that are really require some consultation among the co-chairs of the committee. Perfect. So I think actually maybe the procedural move might be to just recess briefly and have that conversation, because the responses I would give to this group might be basically what I'm going to tell you is that the co-chairs need to work it out.
Work that out. Perfect.
Primarily what I would say.
That's an awesome answer.
So
I'm excited for that answer.
I think I would suggest that conversation first.
Okay, perfect. Okay, and then can you please say about when we ask for clarification, and it's usually up here, right? It's usually up here where nonpartisan sits. Do we usually reflect that in the minutes?
Madam Chair, again, the historic practice typically is that the minutes reflect testifiers who are on the agenda. Yeah. Again, in this environment with the tie and with the power sharing agreement the way that it is, this is it's always up to the committee to decide how to reflect its own minutes, and is the decisions that I would suggest the co-chairs work out together. I'm happy to have that conversation.
Can I tell you how much I appreciate you? Thank you so much. And I'm sorry you came all the way over for that. But
happy to do it.
We respect House Nonpartisan and the great work that you do for our entire body, and we never, never, I think Co-Chair Nash and I both agree, it is never our intent to put you into the political conversation, because in this committee room, it's about the work of the committee. It is not the politics for the campaign trail. So thank you so much. Chair Nash, did you have anything you wanted to add? Thank you so much. Representative Ryer. Again, I apologize for the disruption.
Thank you, Madam Chair. No harm done, and I'm eager to hear from our testifiers. We have a lot of perspectives at the table.
We certainly do. So we will begin with Adam Janik, and then followed by Aaron Wilkie. When you're ready, if you'll please state your name for the record and begin your testimony, please.
Co-Chair Cleaver, Co-Chair Nash, and members of the committee, my name is Adam Janiak, and I'm a negotiation specialist at Education Minnesota. House File 2904 creates a statewide large health insurance pool for all public schools and their employees. The pool, named the Educator Group Insurance Program, or EGIP, would provide increased stability across the state for districts small and large. The EGIP pool would create increased stability by spreading risk over a larger group. The state would oversee the program similarly to how they currently oversee CGIP, the State Employees Group Insurance Program. Importantly, the EGIP program will be modeled after that current state program using the same tiered cost level design. This mirroring in design and the additional size that EGIP brings will provide the state with additional negotiating power when dealing with health insurance carriers and providers. Additionally, a labor management committee will exist to give input and be a part of future decision making around plan design. One of the most important aspects of the large pool would be the efficiency and savings created by lowering administrative costs, eliminating redundancy across school districts, and the elimination of unnecessary service layers. Currently, school districts all across the state are paying for and allocating resources to search, compare, implement, and yet still struggle with health insurance benefits. The time of school personnel and money being spent on services like brokers would be much better used as support for our educators and students to succeed. Minimum employer contribution levels are set by this bill as well. The employer would provide a minimum contribution of 95% of the single premium and 85% of the family premium to eligible employees on the highest value plan. A funding investment is needed for this bill, and it's written containing a hold harmless provision. Districts would be funded the difference between their current premium costs and what costs would result due to the changes in the bill. This investment would make both quality and affordable health care a possibility for educators across the state and provide districts with one of the recruitment and retention tools they desperately need. And the investment would further pay off as the statewide program cost savings in years to come are achieved. Thank you for your time today, and I ask for your full support of House File 2904 and the Educator Group Insurance Program.
Thank you, Mr. Janiak.
Thank you.
And Mr. Wilkie, you are next with Laurie Goff on deck. Thank you. Just state your name for the record.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, thanks for having me here today. My name is Aaron Wilkie. I have served students for 30 years as both a teacher and activities director at Cass and Manorville Schools. I have also served as our local union president, spent a decade or so on the district health insurance selection committee, helped negotiate at least 8 labor contracts, and I'm currently a healthcare action leader and full-time middle school geography teacher. The current system of providing health insurance to public school teachers in Minnesota is simply not sustainable. Over the last 6 years, Cass and Manorville educators have seen an 11.1% average annual premium increase. And we are better off than many of the districts around the state. This while deductibles have nearly doubled to help keep our premiums down. The cost of a current family health insurance premium at Cass and Manorville is around $36,000 a year, depending on the selected plan. Assuming just a 10% annual premium increase, a decade from now, the premium for the same plan will cost about $93,000. Contract negotiations have become nearly impossible to navigate with these increases we are experiencing, and school boards have been forced to pay lower wages and salaries with equally unaffordable health insurance. They do the best they can in a nearly impossible situation. I have colleagues who have had to quit insuring their families as of January 1st, 26. I work with a special education director who worries if she can pay for her cancer treatment drugs each month while she still shows up for work every day. I have personally put off medical treatment for years to avoid the $7,500 deductible I simply cannot afford every single year. To the point, not only are premiums going up, but coverage is getting worse. In order to attract and retain quality teachers, Minnesota needs to have affordable and quality health insurance for ourselves and our families. We need a single large insurance pool. We need to share resources. We need power to negotiate for our health insurance as a single unit. This can't wait. Please support Make EGIP happen. Thank you for having me here today.
Thank you very much for your testimony. We appreciate it. Laurie Goth will be followed by Kristen Scott.
Chair and members, my name is Laurie Goth, and I'm a special education para for the St. Michael Albertville School District. I provide academic support in general education classrooms, and I run the resource room where students can get extra help. There was a time when education support professional jobs were sought after because of the good pay and great benefits. But after 25 years of underfunding by the state of Minnesota, our wages and benefits have not kept up, and positions like mine are hard to fill. When bargaining, the district comes to the table, says, this is your budget, wages or health insurance. Not everyone takes the insurance, but everyone takes the wages. So the insurance gets more expensive and the plans get worse. After decades of disinvestment, my insurance is, well, bad. I'd like to tell you about my son, Jacob. One day he woke up, he couldn't see out of his right eye. After many appointments with many doctors and specialists, and patiently, also known as agonizingly, waiting for test results and numerous MRIs, we found out he has a rare eye disease. It took a year, but the doctors found a way to stabilize it. Unfortunately, the medication that the doctor prescribed, our insurance will not cover. Instead, we are forced to use a medication that is for children with cancer who are waiting for a bone marrow transplant. It suppresses the immune system and has possibly devastating and irreversible long-term side effects. He needs to be on this medication for at least 3 years, but possibly forever. The medication isn't covered by insurance either, but it's $168 a month out of pocket rather than $7,000 for the medication that was actually prescribed. I worked 3 jobs to pay for medical expenses, and my son may still lose his sight. Sorry, that does make me emotional. Imagine telling your child that you can't afford to keep them healthy. I don't want to be just one more sad story, though, but I do want to put a face to a statewide problem. ESPs in every district in our state are struggling to care for our families. This is a statewide problem, and it needs a statewide solution. That's why the statewide health insurance bill is so important. It would allow us to care for our kids at school and our families at home. I encourage you to support this bill. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much, and thank you for sharing your personal story. Next, we have Kristen Scott, followed by Todd Mensink.
Good morning. My name is Kristen Scott, and I'm a proud AFSCME member and a paraprofessional in the Elk River School District. I'm here today to share with you about the burden of health insurance premiums on people like me. Working in public education is a calling. We surely aren't here to get rich. We're here because we love our kids, your kids. We're tasked with taking care of them every day, and we do this for far less than our equally educated counterparts in pretty much every other profession. The amount we pay in healthcare premiums and deductibles has continued to go up year after year, much faster than our wages. The last renewal we had in my school district was 11% higher than the previous year. We had negotiated for a modest increase in the district's contributions to our premiums in our recent contract, and it was barely enough to cover it. It pretty much brought us back to where we started, and now we're looking at another increase. I sat this year on the insurance committee where we listened to a consulting company who has paid five times my yearly salary explain to us how prices are going up for prescriptions and procedures, and how we are going to need at least a 10% increase just to cover expected costs, plus more to increase our reserve. We talked about how many people on our plan are high-cost claimants, because if we have too many of them, it could affect our renewal. God forbid one of our coworkers or our own family member has a heart attack or a car accident or a cancer diagnosis, a premature baby. There's something wrong when someone who is going through one of the worst times in their life could feel bad for using the health insurance that they pay for. Yet these are the considerations that we're talking about, and we have a decent-sized school district. This hits smaller districts even harder. What we're doing now isn't sustainable. We need a more efficient, cost-effective health insurance system, and I believe EGIP is it. When we work together, we have increased bargaining power with the insurance companies and more stability for our families. Please support HF 2904. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Next, we have Todd Mensink, and then followed by Kirk Schneidwind. When you're ready, please state your name and begin your testimony, please.
All right. Hello, my name's Todd Mensink. I'm the Director of Labor Relations and Benefits for Anoka Hennepin Schools. I'm here on behalf of the Association of Minnesota School Districts, Minnesota Association of School Administrators, and Minnesota Association of School Business Administrators to address some concerns we have with the bill. Just so you know, Anoka Hennepin is the largest district in the state. We're currently self-funded and use Medica as our third-party administrator. We have about an $86 million insurance budget, and about 3% of that goes to administrative fees. In recent years, we've had some ongoing large claims for a small number of members that have had a major impact on our premiums. So we understand the concern. If we were a smaller district, these would have been truly catastrophic if they were part of a smaller pool. This bill is in part an attempt to remedy that problem of catastrophic claims. And we appreciate that, but there are some other options we could explore. And some other concerns with the bill that I want to go over. So first, the first part of the bill deals with the statewide pool, basically replacing each individual in district's insurance with a statewide insurance plan. I want to make it clear this will have winners and losers. There are currently districts that have better than average experience will see their premiums go up. Districts that have worse than average experience will see their premiums go down. Similarly, some districts have aggregate value of insurance that is higher, and they'll see the value of their benefits go down. Some have lower, and they'll see the value of their benefits go up. Having said that, that's not necessarily a reason not to go with it. A big concern lots of my colleagues have is that it takes away the opportunity at the local level to find point solutions that might work better for their individual employees. And it doesn't really save a whole lot of cost or administrative burden. So as districts, we're still going to be paying, we're still going to have to run open enrollment, manage life events, COBRA, retirees. Most of our administration stays the same. There may be some savings on TPAs, but currently our broker fees are 0.2% of our premium. So the savings coming from going to just a statewide broker versus each district aren't significant. The main points I guess I'd make here is that All would pay the average premium. It would put all districts on equal standing when it comes to insurance costs in exchange for that ability to make adjustments. One option you could look at that might allow districts to still have their own individual plans would be to provide a statewide reinsurance program to protect districts from catastrophic claims without having to put everyone in a one-size-fits-all option. The second part of the bill is actually the part we're more concerned about, and that's the part that overrides currently negotiated language regarding benefit eligibility and contributions with a standard statewide contribution. It would take any employee that's got 14 hours or more and require us to pay 95% of their single premium and 85% of their family premium, and then provide a subsidy to districts to cover the difference. Just looking at Anoka-Hennepin, if we were to go to EGIP and the plan, if the rates would remain the same as our high plan rates, this would cost us $4,000 for every single employee with single coverage, $17,000 for every employee with family coverage, $27,000 for every employee who moves from single to family, $39,000 for every employee who's currently ineligible and chooses to move to family coverage, and $14,000 for every employee that's currently ineligible and chooses to move to single coverage.
Thank you. I'm going to have to ask you to wrap up, but is a closing statement?
All right. My closing statement is just that this is an expensive bill. We have negotiated language right now to ensure that we can recruit and retrain our teachers. And we feel that the money could be better spent allowing districts to make those decisions with their local unions.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your testimony. And I did not know that Anoka-Hennepin was self-funded. So I want to, Representative Breyer, I'd like to find out how many of our districts are actually self-funded at a different time, offline. Next, we have in our testimony, Kirk Schendelman.
Madam Chair, could I just ask a quick question to the chair?
Is it about this bill?
Just the testimony. If he could provide his testimony, since he was didn't get to finish, if he could provide a written testimony to the members, would that be okay?
Certainly. We can ask for written testimony. No worries.
If you could provide that to us, that'd be great. There was a lot of data.
There were a lot of numbers there.
Thank you.
I agree. Okay.
Good morning. How are you?
Oh, Chair Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the last testifier, as you're cooking some notes together, I'm up here. If you could maybe provide what the potential impact to the Robbinsdale school district might be, because turns out they're not in very good financial situation right now. So I would really like to understand that how that would more than likely adversely impact where they are today.
Thank you very much. And thank you. When you're ready, please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Kirk Schneider, and I'm the Executive Director for the Minnesota School Boards Association, representing all 331 of our locally elected school boards across the state. After listening to the testimony in front of me, if the theory is the bigger is better, then I think that there's a solution in front of you today that to allow our school employees to join the CGIP program that are available to our legislators and other state employees. We saw a similar effort 15 years ago, ultimately leading to a health insurance program called PEEP, which for our school districts proved to be underwhelming. The infrastructure is already built within the CGIP program that we talked about, but instead this bill proposes to build a parallel program that would be a very costly program, as alluded to. School boards support affordable, high-quality health coverage for our employees. We understand the rising health insurance costs are being felt by every sector of the economy. Also, I want to be clear that the care, management, and control of our school districts is really vested in our school boards to have some oversight of the budgets and programs that are provided. And with this bill, the authority seems to be shifting away from our school boards. We have three primary concerns about this bill. First, state control without state accountability. The bill removes local authority over one of the largest components of employee compensation, while leaving school boards responsible for budgets and outcomes. When decisions are made at the state level, but the financial consequences remain local, accountability does break down. Second, mandated costs that that compete with classroom spending. House File 2904 requires employer contributions of 95 and 85 for family and individuals. For one mid-sized school district, this means nearly $500,000 increase in the premiums. Without guaranteed state funding on top recent mandates like unemployment insurance and paid leave, these costs are currently putting pressure on our school districts. And in fact, we did some analysis on a regional center in the state of Minnesota, and we would see their premium increases from $15 million to $26 million. So that would be a $10 million increase for just that regional center that serves around 8,000 students. And we have been gathering information and would be willing to share that with the committee. If this bill becomes law, a 12-person state committee, 10 of whom represent labor, will control benefits and design premium costs, while local school boards and school leaders will be left to address the financial impact. Since school boards have no statutory authority to increase the levy to cover increases in health insurance, budget cuts will likely be an impact of that. Local accountability will be lost. The state's action will result in staff reductions and will have impact on student opportunities. Third, fiscal instability. Districts face significant uncertainty, including potential reductions in special ed funding and compensatory aid in the very short term. Committing state and local dollars to an unproven statewide program instead of established student-centered programs like special education and compensatory revenue increase risk at a time when schools are looking for financial stability and predictability. The bottom line is simple. 2904 shifts control to the state, cost to the school districts, and financial consequences to school districts and programs. We strongly advise the state legislature to fully understand the costs to our school districts and the impact to our state budget. As you know, requesting fiscal notes and local impact notes will help you with this. Our elected school boards oppose the statewide benefits program, statewide health insurance program, that we feel undermines some of the responsibilities and authority of our school boards today. Thank you, Madam Chair, and I can stand for questions.
Thank you very much for your testimony. We have one more testifier that's on the list, Adam Janik. Oh, I'm so sorry. I said the wrong name. All right. I am so sorry. If I could ask Adam Janik to come back to the testifying table and talk about educators joining CGIP. What would that do to CGIP? What would that be about? Or do you have any other comments about that since it was just mentioned?
Thank you, Chair Cleaborn, Co-Chair Cleaborn, and Co-Chair Nash. Your question, if you could, you want us to talk about what we have looked into for CGIP as far as what the options are, or do you want CGIP to speak to
Because you have personnel
that could speak to CGIP as well.
What are the options available in CGIP? And then what would adding the teacher pool to CGIP, if you have a response to that, what would that be like?
Thank you for clarifying. Yeah. So the first part, I'll answer what conversations we've had, what research we've done. I think the second part as to the actual impact would be better for your staff to find out from, whether it's MMB or other. So talking about what we have looked into and what CGIP provides, I know the option of letting someone join CGIP or a group or bargaining units join CGIP. One of the big things when we talk about these pools, whether it's a voluntary pool, as mentioned, that currently exists, such as PEEP, or a static pool or mandatory pool where the employee group, the members of the pool, are set already, like CGIP, is that voluntary or mandatory nature. And when I say mandatory, the set nature of that pool. When we talk about health insurance and that stability and predictability that those pools bring, it's vital when you are looking at a more stable or more predictable group to have that set group. Now, that doesn't mean that a voluntary pool cannot work, but when we talk about that, we want to make sure that we look at that from that lens. And so the idea, and it's a very open statement to say allow to join, to the idea of making CGIP a voluntary pool or putting a voluntary aspect in addition is not something that we would look as an option because that would actually decrease the stability of the CEGA pool, and we have no interest in moving anyone backwards. So when we talked about this and talked about what our options are, and I just want to make sure that we do note that MMB, with the questions that we asked, were amazing, I would say, stewards of your work and the work of this legislature, as they were able to answer what they could and couldn't with fidelity. We do appreciate that when there are so many questions around health insurance. We talked through the different options and what those impacts would be. And so some of the things when we talk about, like, how do you move something forward, well, the idea of changing one thing in order to make another, you know, that does sometimes make things more difficult, even though if someone says, well, why don't they come join it, that makes it sound easier than the realities of getting agreement across not only groups but across aisles as well. So when we looked at that, we wanted to make sure that we found the clearest path to that. But then also when we looked at all of this, the big thing we wanted to make sure we did is have static pools or pool, and we also wanted to make sure that they were as efficient in administration as possible. And so when we boiled down all the different things, whether it's all of the state employees being under one system and all the school districts being in another and how that would look joined together, or how that communication would go, or specifically how the plans would run, when we mirror those, and we talked about that in my, or I talked about that in my testimony of mirroring the plans, we wanted to make sure that, that was maintained so that, again, the state has not only the efficiency but that leverage in negotiations. But then we boiled it down to the question of, if we did it separately as opposed to all together, would we see the same savings? Would we see the same efficiencies? Would we see the same strength for negotiations? And what would the downside be? And the short answer to that, without, you know, having the complete data set that the bill, you know, seeks, is that all things would be strong and good, and those would be achieved as far as negotiating power and efficiency and administrative streamlining. The one small piece would be a little bit of a more administration with two pools, but the benefit of not joining them together, whether it's the transition to that or as it goes forward, is huge. And it also, as one of the testifiers previously talked about, it maintains our voice in that CEGIP plan going forward and on an LMC, where the CEGIP plan is really, while it moves forward with both the state and the bargaining units working together, they do it through a bargaining process. Ours, at the EGIP plan, would be done through an LMC.
And would you like to define that for the public?
Which part, the LMC?
Yes, please.
The Labor Management Committee that is designed in the bill, laid out in the bill, I should say, is a 12-person board that has representatives from different organizations. That LMC would have the state on one side, MMB, and then those 12 named in our bill on the other.
Further questions from the committee? To the testifier, if you, since I asked them to come back up. Okay, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on this bill? Okay, I don't see anyone else in the public. Represent our co-chair Bonner, our vice
thank
chair
you.
Bonner.
And,
thank
and
you.
I'm not sure who the best person as this is maybe the gentleman we just had, I'm sorry. I guess here's my question. So we know that the trajectory of healthcare insurance costs is like a runaway train at this point. And all due respect to our school boards, the reality is I don't know how they stop that train. I don't know how they're gonna do that. And we're looking at all kinds of different options on how to address these issues because, frankly, it's just not sustainable, right? It's not reasonable. We're only here having this conversation because it is so unsustainable and we can't stop the train, right? So if we are trying to do this, and I'm just wondering, given that fact, I'm trying to understand what schools' tools that we think schools have in their toolbox to negotiate a better deal when, on average, we can't do that in any other arena. And I'm trying to understand how school boards are going to be able to negotiate a better deal on a runaway train without having some help in the form of a larger pool to lower that risk and provide stability. And I don't know how to answer that question, but maybe the school board folks have some answer on how school boards have that authority or that ability to stop something like rising prices that are out of their control or out of their scope of control.
Representative Ryer, do you have a response?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd invite testifiers to speak to that if they wish.
So it's tools in the toolbox that you have to negotiate better?
Yeah, we do have some districts that have negotiated point solutions where they'll have employees getting like knee replacements and certain specialty surgeries at local clinics that provide lower costs. So those are things, though, that are I think are at the margin. I mean, I think honestly the answer is school boards don't necessarily have the ability to lower that cost trajectory. But I think we would argue that this bill doesn't lower that cost trajectory either. It evens out what everyone's paying, but ultimately the cost of insurance will go up the same whether we're part of a big pool or whether we're part of lots of small pools. So I hope that's, you know, a satisfactory answer.
Thank you. And Representative Bonner, I'm going to ask to keep these really short because we want to.
I get it.
Yeah, these are questions to the testifiers, and then we're going to go to questions to the bill. Okay, so if you have questions to the testifiers, okay. Do you have questions to the testifier? Okay.
I can save it.
Are you sure? Okay. Representative Clardy.
Thank you. Just a quick clarification. You had mentioned that, or maybe it was my interpretation, that this was competing with other funding streams. Isn't special ed separate from what you would be using this from? So I'm trying to just get a clarification on your point.
So I guess my point was right now we have negotiated insurance contributions. Most districts are not providing 95% single and 85% family. We all could have done that. We made a decision through negotiations to prioritize salary over maintaining Cadillac insurance plans and providing large contributions. And so we do know there's a big cost to this bill. And my contention was just that money could be used in other ways that might be more beneficial.
I think the question was, isn't special education a categorical?
Special education is categorical.
Right, yes. So we don't use that for healthcare. Yeah. That, I think that was the point you were trying to make. Is that correct? Thank you. Representative Kraft.
Thanks. Yeah, I'll have a comment later, but I do have a question. You spoke about some districts being winners and some districts being losers in this proposal. And I wonder, trying to dig into that a little bit, would I be right in thinking that the districts that will be losers in this, that have done have lower costs on insurance, are ones that maybe have had more of, maybe be larger, have more of a chance to power to either dedicate to more resource to dedicate to this or to negotiate with insurance companies, or districts that have yet to experience some catastrophic issues with employees that have driven things up? Is that a reasonable way for me to think about that?
Yeah, more the latter than the former. I mean, like I said, we're the largest district in the state. I'm guessing that we have above average insurance premiums because we've had catastrophic claims. And so, there will be people who see their premiums go up, obviously, because right now they're in, you know, a pool that's healthier.
So thank you, Madam Chair. So just a quick comment. So to me, that means that the districts that would be losers in this are ones that have yet to experience some catastrophic issue, which is kind of the reason we do insurance.
Thank you. Let's see. Representative
Mr. Mensink, yes. Thanks for being in the hot seat. Your district is experiencing or negotiating a contract right now for health insurance.
Yes.
And you're facing increases from your MAC share.
That's
from
right.
Your provider.
Yeah, we're anticipating increases.
Okay. And Madam Chair, who's going to absorb those increases?
It'll be a mix of, employees and employers. So we've negotiated increased contributions for next year over this year. I don't know at this point whether those contributions are going to exceed the increase or not, match the increase in premium costs. Right.
Is there any other follow-up, Representative Lugar-Life? Any questions on this side of the table for the testifier? Okay. Thank you very much for coming forward. This bill is going to be laid over. I just want to make sure that Mr. Benthoff, if you wanted to say anything on behalf of MMB about teachers joining CCAP. Oh, there you are. Thank you. If you'll state your name for the record and then begin your testimony, please.
Chair, Co-Chair Cleavorn, Co-Chair Nash, my name is members of the committee. My name is Galen Benshoof. I'm the Enterprise Director for Employee Insurance at MMB. That means I oversee both the CGIP program for state employees and their families and PEEP, the Public Employee Insurance Program, for units of local government and school districts. We get the question every now and again, why can't just other folks join CGIP? It's obviously a very high-quality insurance program. It has a pioneering tier network design that promotes the use of cost-efficient care. And our answer to that is always that it's an employer plan. And the state is an employer. State agencies, the judicial branch, the legislative branch, technically the state is the employer. And it would become something different if it expanded. It'd become a multi-employer plan, just a different type of health plan. And what this bill would basically do is create a CGIP for educators. Because today, the Public Employee Insurance Program, PEEP, as you've heard in the testimony, it's voluntary. And districts and cities and counties and other public employers can choose to participate or not. Whereas contrast that with CGIP, where state agencies can't just come and go. DNR couldn't opt out of CGIP and go find other insurance. And that helps create the stability and the purchasing power that CGIP has today. The stability, the size, the predictability. And that is functionally what the bill would do for educators. It would create a stable pool where there wouldn't be the coming and going, there wouldn't be the potential instability. So when we say, well, could teachers just join CGIP, essentially what the bill is doing is creating something that would function exactly as CGIP, just for a different population with different employers.
Thank you very much. Any questions to the testifier? Thank you very much. I appreciate the clarification. It's really important. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Sexton.
Thank you, madam. We were talking about the board earlier that's proposed in the bill. Does CGIP have a similar board?
Please proceed.
Chair Cleavorn, Representative Sexton. The benefits offered through CGIP are driven by largely by collective bargaining between the state and participating labor unions. And as an earlier testifier mentioned, the bargaining process would function a little bit differently than what the bill currently creates as the Labor Management Committee. But at the state level as well, we have deep collaboration with participating labor unions. So while it would function a little bit differently, I think the spirit is still the same.
Representative Sexton, a follow-up?
So the short answer is no.
Co-Chair Cleavorn, Representative
proceed.
Sexton, under the current version of the bill, it benefits would not be collectively bargained in the exact same way that they are for state employees and other participants in CGIP.
Thank you.
Any follow-up? No. All right, thank you. Okay, thank you so much. I think we are going to go now to total member discussion about the bill as amended. Chair Nash, did you have a question for the testifier? Okay, thank you so much. Okay. Representative Sexton, thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. Thanks for bringing the bill forward. I mean, this is a huge problem we've got to figure out. I'm not sure this is the right one, though. I did notice, though, under the definition of employer and employee, is included county and municipal hospitals, but we didn't hear from any of those groups today. So I don't understand what the impact is.
Representative Breyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Sexton. So PEEP includes public employees of multiple types, municipalities and the like. So this provides an opportunity for those units to be able to join this so that they aren't, we aren't taking something away and freezing them out.
Any follow-up?
I guess for the total picture, it would have been good to hear from both the employer side and the municipal hospitals as well as the employee side for future reference.
All right. Thank you very much. Representative Kraft, did you have a question?
I have a comment.
Please proceed.
Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Ryer, thank you for bringing this bill. I want to start by grounding us a little bit with something that one of the testifiers said. Health care is something everyone should have. Not being able to afford to keep your kid healthy, why should keeping your kid healthy depend on the amount of money you make? And I also want to talk about one of my constituents is involved in negotiating one of these agreements in the school district he works for, and is saying that now the numbers are coming out for health insurance premiums going into effect next school year and facing between a 15 to 20% increase in premiums, which will turn into an overall pay cut for teachers. You know, why this healthcare is so part of people of compensation is beyond me. I want to close with, there were two statements made that one I disagree with and one I agree with, but I want to go through that. There was a comment that this isn't going to help lower costs in aggregate. And I find that just an irrational comment. And here's why. What we're talking about here is creating a bigger pool, right? Bigger pool, spread costs, more, that's what insurance is about, right? So rationally, this will lower overall costs. Certainly, there'll be some districts that haven't yet experienced catastrophic things that will be paying a bit more. But in aggregate, this is going to drive costs down. And you just look to things that the federal government is doing, where they're negotiating, Medicare is negotiating 10 high-cost drugs to drive costs down. It's the same concept. The other comment was made is that ultimately costs are going to go up anyway. I agree with that too. We have an unsustainable healthcare system in this country. Right? We spend per person more than $6,000 more than countries, other developed countries, on healthcare, and we get worse outcomes. So this is an important issue. I help you bring it up. It's a Band-Aid on the overall issue, but I thank you for bringing this bill.
Thank you so much. I'm going to ask members to be brief. We still have two more bills. And Representative Bonner, I cut you off last time, so you get latitude. Please go ahead.
Thank you. I'm just going to, in the interest of time, make a comment here. I mean, first I want to say one thing that struck me when we were talking about this and about people asking about having a Cadillac plan. What does that mean? That means actually having a plan that cares for your family. I don't call that a Cadillac. I'd call that a Honda Accord. Just saying. So I think we want to be careful about that. But the reality of this is that we live in a market economy. I mean, I think that we understand the economic factors at play here. This is a runaway train in which, frankly, it's a fool's errand for any school board or anyone to try and place themselves in front of a moving train. It is just crazy. And I think we have to acknowledge that fact and call a spade a spade. The reality is, in a market economy, we know that larger pools means that we lower our risk. We have a greater ability to spread out that risk over that larger pool, bring down costs, and bring down premiums. Yes, they're going to go up. That's going to happen. We also have to be clear-eyed that this plan means, yes, we would have to spend some money up front. But the real question we have to be asking ourselves, members, is what happens if we do nothing? That runaway train, it's already left the station, folks. And I think the cost of doing nothing or not having these conversations about how we actually slow the train down just a little bit, it seems crazy to me. So with that, I'm going to leave it there, but just end with, we know that this model works. We know that it's been proven. We know that spreading out that risk actually does lower costs for everyone across the system and makes it more stable and sustainable. We don't want another Medica another UCare on our hands. So thank you for that.
Thank you very much. Chair Nash, do you have any?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple of comments to either the author or you, Madam Chair. Have we seen, received, or requested fiscal note, local impact note for this?
They have been requested.
Okay. And then just a question for the author. Isn't a large portion of this predicated on individual school districts being able to successfully pass an operating levy to cover the parts that they would be required to cover?
Representative Breyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Chair Nash. School districts are already taking responsibility for these things, and so I think that they will continue to do so.
Chair Nash.
Madam Chair, thank you. Well, that wasn't really the question, but I mean, so on the outside chance that this becomes more expensive, because things often sometimes happen that way, and an operating levy is out of sync with the increase in costs, it might put it in a very perilous position for a lack of funding. And if you can't fund it, you have to go to the taxpayer, and that's not something that municipalities do. They pass a levy each year, but school districts have to pass a special operating levy under a vote. If the vote was unsuccessful, that's my question. What happens if the vote is unsuccessful with a potentially more expensive plan that you're proposing?
Representative Breyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chair Nash, I think you're raising a point that we will continue to discuss. We've been talking about the financing mechanisms and what it looks like, and I expect to be having extensive conversations with school districts and with the organizations of superintendents and school boards, and we'll talk through that.
And then, Madam Chair, we're laying this over.
Correct.
We're awaiting the forecast tomorrow. Thank you.
The motion is to lay it over. Thank you very much. Any closing comments before we leave?
No, I appreciate the time of the committee and all the feedback, and look forward to moving forward in due course.
Thank you very much. And with that, we'll move on. I will restate my motion to lay this bill over as amended. Next, we will move on to Representative Hicks. Thank you.
And renaming
me? Yeah, screaming your name. Thank you. Representative Sexton, this is your question, or no? Yeah, this is your. Representative Hicks, as you're getting ready, Representative Sexton would like to talk about a friendly amendment.
Oh.
It's.
Pardon? No, that's fine.
Yeah, I will.
Happy to chat. A verbal amendment?
I'm letting people move before we move. So, Representative Hicks, I will move that House File 3422 be before the committee. It is my intention to lay this bill over for possible inclusion, and that is the motion before us. And with that, if you would please discuss your bill.
Thank you so much, Chair. Thank you so much for committee, to the committee for hearing this bill today and considering it for possible inclusion. This bill takes some of what is best practice and is already happening in grants management across the enterprise and puts it into statute. So if you look on line 2.8, you can see that it requires virtual site visits for grants less than $50,000, annual in-person for $50,000 to $250,000, and biannually in-person for grants over $250,000. It also takes and increases, it takes what is already happening across the enterprise and puts it into statute regarding financial reconciliations. So that before the final payment, a financial reconciliation has been done, with quarterly reconciliations being required for any grants over $500,000.
Thank you very much. Is that all you wish to say?
It's pretty self-explanatory. Go look at the places, make sure they're doing the work, and check their math.
Thank you. I so appreciate you. Representative Sexton, would you like to talk about your potential friendly amendment.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you. Great bill. Just came to me last night. I apologize. I didn't have a chance to verbalize it prior to the meeting since we didn't meet. if you look at line 1.9, and there's a sentence that ends particular grant programs period, I'm suggesting that we add a line that says the commissioner shall provide an annual report to the legislature due in January of each year, summarizing each exemption given or renewed and the circumstances or background substantiating the exemption. So we, the legislature, can learn about these exemptions and potentially make the bill even better in the future. And so I can work with Chair in your absence, for you, Mr. Sullivan, whoever, if you think that's worthy to pursue.
Thank you very much. And because we're laying this bill over, we are not adopting any amendments today, but I just wanted to make you aware of the comments that Representative Sexton has. Is there any more discussion to the bill? Vice Chair Davis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Hicks, for bringing this bill. I had a similar version of this in House File 2 last year. This is a little bit more watered down, but I think it does take steps in the right direction to deal with fraud. I wish I could have gotten Democrats on board with it last year, but no one seemed to be too interested. But I'm wondering if, so you're saying virtual monitoring visit, and by the way, Madam Chair, is grants management here?
I can answer the question, Rep. Davids.
Okay. Just asking.
Thank you.
I may have some questions for grants management, but you're saying just a virtual monitoring visit, is that annually? If I'm understanding that correctly, that's annually, correct?
Yes.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you. Yes, that is what it is, and it would be for those grants under $50,000. And if you'd like to talk about what happens in those monitoring visits, I'd be happy to go into that depth either now or in a separate time because I know we're pressed for time, but I'd love to walk through what happens during monitoring visits with you. I think it is a really awesome process that grants management has put into place. I'm really impressed with the safeguards that are present, and I'd love to explore it further with you if you'd be willing to grab a cup of coffee and have that conversation. I'd be happy to do it.
Representative Davis.
Sure. Just for the sake of the committee, could you just briefly touch on what goes into a virtual
Yes, I would love that.
If I could finish my question.
Sorry, it's my favorite thing.
If I could finish my question.
Yes, of course, Representative.
Okay.
Sorry.
I know you're very excited about this. But virtual monitoring visits, because like in my mind, I'm just going, how can you actually verify that they're where they say they are, and how can you verify that they're actually doing what they say they're doing with a virtual? So I'm just trying to understand the virtual a little bit better. Do they take the laptop if they're doing like a Zoom meeting or something, or a Teams meeting, and walk it around, or like how would that work?
Representative Hicks.
Yes. So maybe. That would kind of depend on the monitoring visit and what the type of grant is. Because remember, this is across the enterprise. So this would be every grant, you know, this would imply any grant from like, you know, grants for cows to grants for kids and everything in between, right? Because it's across the enterprise. And so it could, depending on it, what the grant looks like. But a lot of times what virtual monitor visits look like is prior to the monitoring visit, if it's virtual, and even if it's not virtual, sometimes in person, depending on the scope of the grant and how in-depth the documentation is, it may be requested in advance or it may be reviewed on site. Sort of depends on the situation. But they will request documentation for example, hiring practices, subcontractor contracts, client files, if there are clients that are directly served by the grant, if it's a grant that serves people directly, staff files, if you're paying for a staff out of a grant. You would request payroll records. You would look at liability insurance, theft insurance, vehicle insurance if the grant drives. Make sure all of those are up to date. You would review the work plan that was submitted for the grant and what are the goals in that work plan. What was the most recent progress note? If they're depending, progress report, depending on if they're like quarterly required or 6 month required. Sort of depends on the grant, right? But whatever's in that contract, how are those? You would go into the state's tracking system, and you would look at invoices, and you would compare invoices to grant spending, and you would calculate the percentage of, like, they're supposed to be at 60% because we're 60% through the grant, but we're only at 58%. Great. We're pretty much on target, so you'd have a conversation about that. If you did that and they were overspending, that would be part of your virtual monitoring visit. You'd walk through where those over expenses are, why they're happening, what needs to change, if anything needs to change in the grant to make sure that they don't overspend, because we can't authorize payments that are overspent. The same thing if they're underspent. We would have the exact same conversation in that realm. We would also review any materials created by the grant, which is kind of, I think, one of the coolest parts of grant monitoring. So if we have a grant, for example, I'm going to pick something random. If we have a grant that is doing something about seed knowledge, let's say we're teaching kids about seeds, for example, right? We would see all the materials that they're using to teach the kids about seeds. What is the curriculum? Who developed it? What are the promotional materials? How are they promoting it? Where are the signs? How are they getting folks involved? All of that is part of a robust grant monitoring visit. And if it's done virtually, we would review those documents together. Sometimes the grantees will put together PowerPoints, you know, to kind of put that together and then send materials. In other cases, it is sometimes walking around the laptop. And the in-person visits are very similar, except for you get to go into the space and do that. And the reason that I differentiated the two is simply because of resources and amounts of money. As you can see, I think we should do 2 annual visits if you're getting $250,000. That's a lot of money, and yeah, you should do 2 visits. If you're getting $50,000 over 2 years and you're packaging up seeds, maybe we can have that conversation virtually so we don't have to pay staff to drive 50 miles, 100 miles, you know, depending on the situation, and pay for hotel lodging if it's up over by the Canadian border, and cost taxpayers substantial amounts of money in those oversight visits if we can do them by walking the laptop around.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Great job, and I like the direction that you're taking this in. I would definitely like to continue working with you on this because we haven't yet. But I apologize if I missed this in your testimony.
No,
but did you request a fiscal note? Because I think it is going to be very expensive to codify this in the law, especially with the biennial thing, which is fine. I want there to be, but I'm just wondering if you've requested a fiscal note.
Representative Hicks.
I have not, because this is already best practice through grants that we're supposed to be doing. So this would just put it into law. So I don't think it should cost money to do what we're already doing, but I could be wrong.
Thank you, Ms. Just last thing, Madam Chair, and this is where I think it'd be very helpful to hear from grants management, because I actually met with them at my cubicle last year, and there were some huge concerns with that. So thank you.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My concern is, having seen audits, and there's already stuff they're supposed to be doing, and it's quite common to have the majority of site visits never happen. And one thing that I think is a little bit missing is you can have the greatest processes, but if they aren't performing and actually doing it, and there's no repercussions, I don't see how they're not going to continue to basically not do the oversight.
Representative Hicks, do you have any comments?
I would just say that's why I want to put it in statute, because policies and recommendations should be followed, but if they aren't being followed, that is not the same thing as violating the law. And so I am optimistic that by putting it in statute, we will solve that problem. And I recognize that it may not. I get that. I understand that there will always be employees who maybe do not follow the directions. I think we've all worked with coworkers where you're like, listen, you need to do your job. Okay. We've all had those folks. But if the response is people won't do it anyway, so we shouldn't do anything, that is not helpful. And so I really firmly believe that we should try to do something.
Thank you very much. And Representative Quam, very briefly, please.
Right. Madam Chair, this is going to be held over. I'd love to see actual details of consequences and punishment or disciplinary actions included, because there are things in law already, required things, that they're not doing.
Representative Hicks, if you have an opportunity to review the O'Malley report, some of that is in the O'Malley report as well. Anyone else with a question? I want to thank you for your great work. I really like this bill, and I think most of us who serve on this committee would greatly appreciate your work. Any closing comments before we move on?
No, I know you're short on time, so I'll get out of the way.
Thank you very much. And with that, I will renew my motion that House File 3422 be laid over for possible inclusion. And with that, we will move very quickly to House File 3461. Representative Lugar-Nicolai. Okay. Would you like to move your bill to be laid over for possible inclusion?
Yes, I would like to do that.
Oh, so moved. Thank you.
I have 10 testifiers. Is that okay? No, I'm just
kidding. Okay. If you would please describe your bill for the committee. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair. This morning, this is a short bill. This is hopefully a simple bill. This is really just a matter of conformity between chapters 43A and chapter 3. So 43A.32 provides the terms and conditions for an individual who comes to state service or comes to legislative service from state service. Chapter 3.088 describes the similar thing if you are working for a local unit of government. In Chapter 3.088, there are clear guidelines that ensure essentially a type of escalator provision for individuals who are working as public school teachers, public law enforcement, that they are held harmless for their years of service in the legislature and taking time away from their years of public service as a public servant. Some of those positions, those are missing in 43A.32, and so this bill just ensures that they are the same. There really should be no need for a difference. I suspect it is only an accident of the timing of the creation of the statutes.
Any member discussion to the bill? Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Is this the new representative's first bill?
Yes, sir. Yes, it is.
Oh, we should.
This committee chair does not require snacks as hazing.
Sorry.
Was there a further question, Representative Anderson?
Well, we are meeting again next week, so.
Thank you. Any other questions to the bill? Any discussion? Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Lugar-Nicolai. I appreciate you coming strongly into this committee and not participating in these hazing rituals, so thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Koznick.
I just want to point out, thank you for congratulations on your first bill. Representative did a nice job. There's two chairs on our side of the committee. You are a member of the Transportation Committee. We have different rules.
Okay. Any other?
Madam Chair, I'm a very qualified baker, and I will do it voluntarily and not as a result of hazing.
Thank you very much. That's a whole different ball of wax. Any other discussion to the bill? Representative, I would like to thank you tremendously for taking on this bill. It's really important that everyone have an opportunity to serve in the legislature without fear of losing their ability to support their families. So thank you very much for the work that you've done. Do you have any closing comments?
No, Madam Chair, I'll keep it short. I just want to make sure everybody is sort of held harmless, especially when they are similarly situated, as is the case with our local units of government.
Thank you very much. And with that, I will renew my motion that House File 3461 be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you very much. And with that, our next meeting will be on Tuesday, March 3rd, 2026. Chair Nash, do you have anything you want to say before I gobble us up? With that, members, we are adjourned.